We need to be laser focused on that and do a much better job. Some of the reasons why that's occurring, we see medication errors, we see missed diagnoses, delayed diagnoses, all sorts of things that are really causing that. So I think that we're not as far along as I think anybody thought we would be on the quality and safety agenda post 1999 to Air is Human. We're not as far along on the value-based care journey as we expected to be. And I think that there's one sort of underlying reason for that, maybe one of a few or many, but certainly one that is missed a lot, which is the workforce readiness to deliver high quality, safe care, to meet the demands and promise of value-based care. We tell people what to do in healthcare all the time. Make it safer, make it more affordable. But we are not really good at telling people, the workforce, the leaders, how to achieve it. And that is really where we need to focus is as much on the how as we are on the what.
This is Inspiring Women, and today I'm speaking with Stephanie Mercado. Now, Stephanie has been an executive leader in healthcare for over 20 years, but for the past 10 years, she's been at the helm of NAHQU, the National Association of Healthcare Quality. Stephanie was also most recently recognized as a top 100 most influential person in healthcare. I'm really excited to be speaking with you, Stephanie. Thank you for being on Inspiring Women.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, Stephanie, let's get into it. And where I want to start is I want to talk a lot about quality, the state of play in quality, why it's becoming so important. Why wasn't it always so important? And but maybe if you could just start with like day to day, what does it look like to be at the helm of NAHQU?
Complex and super fun. So healthcare is moving about a mile a minute and the stakes are really, really high. And so we are really living that at NAHQU, really trying to stay out front, ahead of a lot of the issues that are going on in the industry, and really trying to position ourselves as a driving force and a solution to meet some of the most pressing challenges that are facing healthcare today. Those challenges for us are vast, but I think could be sort of summarized in three words: care, cost, and cliff. We want to stay ahead of where healthcare delivery is going. We want to make sure that from a cost perspective, that we are helping to make healthcare sustainable and that we are readying ourselves for the workforce cliff, because we know workforce shortages are going to get much worse over the next 15 years. And we really see quality and safety, equity and value as huge drivers and really business strategies to advancing all of that. So we keep ourselves quite busy at NAHQU headquarters.
Yeah, well, I want to sort of like almost go back a little bit. So can you just like tell us, like, what does NAHQU do? Like, what is the association for? What is it defining in terms of setting standards for the industry in the area of quality?
So NAHQU began as a professional membership and certification organization serving individual contributors. The organization started in 1976 and has rich history and great experience in the space. What we have evolved to is really meeting the market where it's at. And that involves very much advancing healthcare organizations as they aim to increase their capabilities of their staff and then to build capacity for quality and safety. So we actually can support individual contributors, but also come into healthcare organizations to help them figure out how to set up and situate healthcare quality in a more effective way so that they can achieve their results. So we are on the front end of the workforce development sort of side of quality and safety, making sure that the workforce is coordinated and that it is competent and aligned to do its very best work.
And I like the focus on, you know, that you started with on like the cliff. I mean, you know, I think that everyone is becoming acutely aware just in the industry of the workforce shortages, the, you know, the burden that clinicians are feeling, the burnout we talk about, and that has to have impact on quality. And nothing about that sounds like a good thing in terms of what's out there. So Stephanie, maybe even like if we can get really basic, what can you just define quality for us and safety? How should we be thinking about that?
Well, those are big questions. And actually, Nikki does a lot of research on that. It is, yes, because as healthcare has evolved over many decades, so has the definition of quality. So, you know, back in the 60s, when Lyndon B. Johnson signed Medicare into law, quality was really all about utilization review. Then quality became much more about compliance. Over the past couple of decades, it's really had a focus on improvement. And today it really means equity and safety and value. And so with that, you know, all sort of in the mix, it means different things to different people. But to us, it is both the process and the result that we are looking to achieve so that we can have people living their very best lives.
So if we take that and like, let's just move it front to the patient's perspective, because I think that, you know, as a person who might go into a hospital or might be receiving care, I mean, those are stressful times. There's always, you know, something else that you're thinking about. How does a patient think about quality? I mean, they don't care about everyone leading their best lives in the hospital. They care about getting best care for whatever they're going to see a physician or clinician for.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, leading NICU is one thing. And, you know, I myself and my family members are often patients in the healthcare environment. I think patients walk into it with the full faith and trust that the industry and the people working in healthcare have been fully trained on quality and on safety. And in fact, that is not universally true. Most people that you walk past in the hallways or interact with in a healthcare delivery setting, whether it's physicians or nurses or tech, or even people in the executive offices, have all been trained really differently or not at all in quality and safety competencies. And so I think from a patient's perspective, you know, most recently I was in the hospital with my son. My youngest was diagnosed with meningitis. Yikes. And it was very scary. And I wanted Ben to be safe. And I wanted to make sure that his medication was dosed correctly and that he didn't get an infection from his procedure. And that if something went wrong, that the oxygen that was sort of stationed there on the wall was actually going to be flowing when and if they needed to, you know, administer that to Ben. So these are all the things that behind the scenes, you know, healthcare is working hard to make sure are working properly and that they are doing the best work for the patients. But mistakes happen and we are humans. And so I think that, you know, we can do a better job for our patients and their families to make sure that we're a little more consistent from a quality and safety perspective and that we're focused on the highest priority areas that really cause a lot of risk and harm to patients.
Well, first of all, that sounds extraordinarily scary as a mom. How is Ben? How is your son?
He's doing great. He bounced back pretty quickly. We were in the hospital for about a week and he bounced back about a week after that. It took us about 2 more weeks to bounce back.
Well, I'm really glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it. And, you know, as a mom, but also as the head of the helm of, you know, the standards as it relates to quality and safety, I'm sure you were checking a whole bunch of things that what I would just say a normal patient, layperson might not be thinking about. Now, as you know, Stephanie, I come from the electronic health record space. That's where I grew my career in healthcare. And it was 1999 when To Error Is Human came out that really put a spotlight on the fact that, hey, we didn't have consistency. We didn't necessarily have standards for the adoption of technology. And this was just clinical documentation and electronic health records, which led to a sea change of adoption of new standardized approaches for documentation. So in the world of quality, as a patient, I expect it to just be in there. What is the state of play really, you know, across the United States in terms of quality?
So I think we can be excited and optimistic about the marvels of modern medicine, because they are, you know, saving lives and improving lives every single day. I also think that we have a long way to go, most certainly on the safety agenda. At present, approximately one in four people who are entering the healthcare system to get better, to solve what ails them, will experience harm or death as a result of that experience. And we need to be laser focused on that and do a much better job. Some of the reasons why that's occurring, we see medication errors, we see missed diagnoses, delayed diagnoses, all sorts of things that are really causing that. So I think that we're not as far along as I think anybody thought we would be on the quality and safety agenda post 1999 to AIR as Human. We're not as far along on the value-based care journey as we expected to be. And I think that there's one sort of underlying reason for that, maybe one of a few or many, but certainly one that is missed a lot, which is the workforce readiness to deliver high quality, safe care, to meet the demands and promise of value-based care. We tell people what to do in healthcare all the time, make it safer, make it more affordable, but we are not really good at telling people, the workforce, the leaders, how to achieve it. And that is really where we need to focus, is as much on the how as we are on the what.
Yep. And we've moved just in healthcare in terms of, you know, sort of like the physician being the sort of like, you know, one person in charge of sort of like all things, perhaps, you know, for a patient, to really this team-based care environment. Whose responsibility is quality in the healthcare delivery system?
Well, most people would say quality is everyone's job. And yep. Therefore, it's hard for it to be anyone's job.
Yep.
So just a couple words on that, you know, so yeah, we used to have our primary care physicians were the quarterback for the healthcare team.
Yep.
And that is no longer the case. And so what I observe is that we've put five generations of individual contributors to work in healthcare to produce high quality, safe, cost-effective care. But they're all approaching that very differently. They all have different skills. They all have different competencies, and they all have different sensibilities for quality and safety as well. So just putting them together doesn't solve the problem, or telling them to do better doesn't solve the problem. I think what we really need to do is to be figuring out how we specifically define the role that each individual contributor will play in advancing quality and safety. And then we figure out how to put those teams together to do their best work. In our research, we find that a lot of individual contributors are not at the doing the level of work or the type of work they need to be doing. And not only that, but they're not sort of docking in to their team in the most effective way. So I think a real need to focus on, you know, how we ready and align workforces to achieve quality and safety.
Right. And I think that, I mean, there's no clinician or care deliverer that does not want to deliver quality. So like that is, you know, I think that we can all expect that. But standards are emerging. NAQ is defining some of those standards in terms of the language of quality and how to apply that to the workforce. As you do that work, Stephanie, and you think about sort of like what's needed, one of the things that we saw in the adoption of EHRs, one of the accelerants evidence of that started to be when there were incentives to adopt, you know, standardized tools, and then penalties if you didn't adopt them. But then that also caused some negative effects, a whole bunch of burden, higher costs in some instances, not taking costs out of the system. So as we look at emerging standards for quality and safety, a lot of which is the work of NAICQ, how do you see it playing out? Are there penalties? Are there incentives in place to adopt some of the work of NAICQ and other standards emerging?
Yeah, well, there are, you know, lots of reward and incentive programs and penalty systems for healthcare today. And they're just vast and incredibly complex. What we would like to see is more reward for organizations that are sort of structurally orienting their organizations for success. So we hear a lot about outcome process measures and outcome measures. That has sort of been the name of the game in healthcare quality and safety and really measurement. One of the things that we think we could do a better job on is actually focusing on structural measures. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that is the things that must be sort of foundationally in place in order to achieve, you know, process outcomes or higher processes or outcome measures. And so those structural elements would include things like a highly engaged board who is really locked into the quality and safety agenda, knowledgeable about that, invested in that. It would include things like a workforce that is supported and trained by their leaders. Today, about half of the people who are trained in quality and safety are paying for it themselves. Their employers are not paying for that. And so we would like to see structural progress being made on competency-based training, certainly funding for that training, and getting executives really engaged and board members in quality and safety.
Yeah, well, there's definitely something happening here in terms of, I mean, quality going from, you know, sort of like an unfunded mandate to really sort of moving out of the basement into the boardroom in a different and new way. And I also, you know, Stephanie, I want to congratulate you on being recognized as a top 100 most influential person in the United States in the world of healthcare. I mean, certainly a testament to you, but also the work that you're doing in NAICQ. Now, I've heard you called just in some circles as a force of nature, but what should we take from this recognition? You know, in addition to you being fantastic, what does it say about sort of what's happening in quality across the states, quality and safety across the states today?
Yeah, well, I think what it is pointing towards is that quality and safety has gone from the basement to the boardroom. And not only do we have a seat at the table, but we have a commanding seat at the table, and that quality and safety, if leveraged as a business strategy, can really solve a lot of the challenges that we have today. I also think that the recognition was important, not just for me, and thank you for that, but really for NAICQ, because the National Association for Healthcare Quality has been leading on this, and there has not been another organization before, nor will there actually be one ever again, to was sort of first on the scene that said, we're going to own this issue. We're going to own the issue of the profession of healthcare quality, advancing the discipline of healthcare quality, and we're going to be the professional home for the people and the leaders really advancing this cause. And we're going to define that through a competency standard and really try and bring shape to something that has really been left unkept for too long. So it was a great nod to NAICQ and all of the leadership from our staff and board who have been fully supportive and engaged along this really exciting journey.
Well, congratulations. And again, we have a long way to go. So, you know, keep at that work, because I think that we all want to just simply expect and not worry about, you know, harm issues that you were talking about. Stephanie, I want to turn the conversation sort of back to you. And again, I wasn't kidding. You have been called a force of nature in some circles. What did you want to be when you grew up? When you were little, what were you thinking about back then?
So, two things. One, I was always interested in healthcare, but I was not interested in being a clinician. So I never knew exactly what that, you know, how that would work, what that would, what shape that would take. But I was very interested in a profession of being a journalist. So I wanted to be that sort of like the person telling the story and really bringing stories to life. And so that was my early ambition, was to be in journalism.
Okay. And so at what point along this career journey, you know, from journalist to to C-suite executive on national stages, when did sort of like the C-suite kind of power positions that you are in, when did that become something that, oh, I want that? Did you just get fall into it? Was it a pursuit? What's that all about?
Yeah, I think it was a very intentional sort of, you know, growth effort and strategy on my part. And when I realized that I would be good at it was when I actually sort of channeled that journalistic training, because I think a big part of leadership is being able to come into a situation, an industry, an organization, and be able to get your arms around that. And in order to do that, you have to really be able to both have that bird's eye view, but come in on the ground and have a nuanced understanding of things. And so I think, you know, one of my strengths is being able to help people understand where they were, where they are, and where they're going, and then to actually take them there and to bring them along on that journey and really unleash the human potential that is on boards and that is part of staff teams and say, you know, we can get there and we're going to get there together.
Yep. So Stephanie, you, you have an amazing presence, confidence, you know, in terms of how you show up, in so many different ways, behind the scenes in the head, are you as confident as you appear all the time?
Well, there's always some of that self-talk, right? I think anybody who doesn't have some of that negative self-talk, or doubtful self-talk is probably maybe a little too big for their britches, and should be careful, because nobody is that good. So I think that yes, I have a good presence, you know, the things that you're saying, but it is really important to check yourself, I think. But also not to be too mean to yourself. I heard someone say once, you know, if somebody talked about my best friend the way that you were talking about yourself, I'd, you know, you know, knock them out. And so I think we need to remind ourselves of that too, that we should be careful and thoughtful about how we handle ourselves, but never too hard. If we can be a little gracious with other people, maybe we should try and do that with ourselves. And that requires constant discipline to be able to do that, especially if you're a perfectionist, and I'm probably one of those. So
okay. So just like along that journey and having an expectation of yourself that this is intentional, I want to achieve these levels of you know, sort of power positions, top of the pyramid types of positions that you're in. Was there some point along the way, some learning, something that stuck out to you that helped you get there? Because, you know, so many women who are ascending into leadership, they are working hard to quell the self-doubt. They are working hard to build the skills that you have clearly built. What can you give us an example of a time or an experience that helped you before you were the person that you are today?
Yeah, I mean, probably there's many of them. So I would say, first of all, very important to be prepared. So I think it's very hard to be confident if you are not prepared. A lot of people will get out and maybe sort of get ahead of their skis on some things and not be able to walk the talk. So I think that's important. But I can remember one instance in particular where I was maybe underestimated and was at a dinner with a very powerful and impressive man who's a CEO of a major healthcare organization. And he was sort of, you know, sending me in a direction and said, well, why don't you just go work with, you know, that guy, because he's your peer. And I you know, kind of quickly, even almost on a reflex, snap back and said, you know, that individual is not my peer. And I've tried to work with them before, and I am really trying to push an agenda. So let's get the right people in the room and let's get some stuff done. And so I think that moments like that, you know, sometimes they certainly surprise the person on the other end of the table, but they bring a certain level of, you know, respect and, you know, curiosity about the capabilities of the individual. And sometimes I'm surprising myself with those things, right? I didn't know that until I said it. And, but I think it was right.
Well, that's such a cool story. First of all, that's awesome. And when you do surprise yourself in those moments of reflex that also demonstrate, you know, like you are all that you are, and can actually command the moment. Those are the types of things that sort of like build for the next time and the next time. So Stephanie, as you think about, and just, you know, for all these other, I'll just say, you know, women who want to be Stephanie Mercado, you know, in their career journeys, what advice would you give them? What advice would you give to other people who are aspiring to be a leader like you?
I would say, do your homework, work really hard, be able to absolutely walk the talk. And I would say, also the secret, maybe one of the secrets to my success has been, very much knowing when to, push hard and go fast, and when to slow down, and when to be patient. Because both, you know, most certainly, you know, have a role to play in sort of how you show up. And so I think that pacing and timing a lot is absolutely everything. And I also think that just really spending time and developing yourself. One of the favorite things for me about my career, and especially my career at NACU, I've been here 10 years. I was a very different person, and NACU was a very different organization 10 years ago. And I think that if you think about all of the challenges that are ahead, even the ones that are, you know, maybe, you know, take your breath away for a minute here and there, what I view them as is an opportunity to continue to reinvent and redefine myself, and to really push myself to places that I didn't even think that I was capable of going. I wouldn't define myself. What were the words that you used?
Top leader, force of nature.
No, force of nature. What? Yeah. I would not describe myself as force of nature. I would describe myself as just hardworking and, you know, eye on the goals and advancing the mission.
Yep. Well, the last question I want to ask you, Stephanie, as we close out here, you know, top leaders, I often see a sort of like through line that they're lifelong learners, and they're always, you know, sort of like, you know, they never feel like they know enough. And that's always sort of like a death knell, if you will, if you believe that. So just as someone who is a learner and pushes yourself, what are you learning recently that surprised you?
Oh my gosh. So many things. So, I think, part of the learning is just keeping up with current news. So I read a lot about what's going on, in the healthcare environment and otherwise. One of the other things I've started to do, you know, I'm a little pressed for time. I have a lot going on with NACU. I do have, two sort of, small-ish children at home, 10 and 14 years old. And a husband and a dog, and rather busy. And so I have found
and hockey, this, right? Isn't there, oh, wait, isn't hockey. There, don't you have that in your life?
Two kids and travel hockey. Yeah. So it's a lot. But what I would say is one of the things that I've tried to figure out is like, how can I continue to consume information without having it bog me down, and also not just totally abandoning that idea that I would want to keep learning. So there is a new app that I'm pretty into, and it's called Headway. I don't know if you know what it is, but it's it's sort of like the Reader's Digest version of a lot of interesting books that are out there. And so what I found is if I can spend 15 or 20 minutes while I'm walking the dog or on the treadmill or something and listen to one of those, if I'm interested, then I can kind of dig in and you know, access the entire publication. So that's been, I think, a really effective way for a busy person to kind of try and stay engaged in some new content that is out there.
Well, that is awesome. I will check it out. And this has been a great conversation. You've been generous with your time, Stephanie. I've been talking to Stephanie Mercado. And Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of Inspiring Women with Lori McGraw. Please subscribe, rate, and review. We are produced by Kate Cruz at Executive Podcast Solutions. More episodes can be found on inspiringwomen.show. I am Lori McGraw, and thank you for listening.